For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be back. Hope none of you came here last week, because you'd be pretty alone if you were here in the parking lot all by yourself. But today, we want to get back to the series that we started at the beginning of the year, this whole question of, is the Bible in any way relevant to our lives today? And so we've talked about the relationship between the Bible and science, which I would just put forth to you, demonstrates that there is a high likelihood that an infinite, personal, omnipotent God does in fact exist, and in reference to whom we can make sense out of the cosmos that exists. We talked about the dilemma of evil and how really we can only make sense out of the catastrophe that is the human condition in the framework of an understanding of an all-loving God who has granted free choice to his creation. And while allowing us to abuse our freedom against one another, against ourselves, against God himself, that he's moving in history to redeem or to reconcile the brokenness of humanity. That there's really hope for the broken situation of humanity only in relation to God. Now this morning we want to probe just a little bit more deeply. We want to talk about, can we really believe the biblical narrative? We've been talking in kind of general terms, really, almost philosophical or scientific terms up to this point. And now we want to drill down into what does the Bible actually say, and can we trust what it says about Jesus Christ and who he is and what he's come to do? So we want to talk this morning about biblical prophecy. And to get us geared up for that examination of a number of important prophetic texts, I want us to think about this from the logical point of view. For many years, I taught logic before teaching the Bible here, and one of the things that you do in logic, one of the central principles of logical thinking, logical reasoning, is that for every claim that's given, there must be a corresponding proof or support. So if I make a fairly uncontroversial claim, then I can appeal to a fairly low standard of evidence. If I make a strong or even outrageous claim, then the need for that evidence goes higher and higher. If I was to say to you here this morning, guess what? I've got news for you. I was born in 1957. Most of you be like, so? Who cares? And indeed, it doesn't really make that much difference to anyone besides me. But if you were to doubt that statement I'm making, it would be very easy just to go to Mount Carmel Hospital, summon medical records, and find out indeed that is the case. You could talk to my mom, my siblings. They would all vouch for the fact that I exist and that I was born at that time. Very easy to correlate the claim that's made with the evidence necessary to ground it in reason. What if I was to say, I have in my hand here a cup, and inside that cup is a nectar, is an elixir, is a serum that I have brought together, and if you drink it, you will never have cancer. He'd say, now wait a minute. We need some evidence here, and not the kind of evidence where I go to the hospital and find your birth certificate. We want to know, you know, show me the lab reports, how many other scientists have evaluated this thing, what kind of longitudinal studies have been done. Show me the patients who've taken this elixir and have been cured of their cancer. And what about the long-term track record of this? We want to know a lot of information, right? Because why? Because the claim is just such a seemingly outrageous claim that the need for evidence just skyrockets. And then there's this kind of claim. The Son of Man has the authority on heaven to forgive sin. That is a very high claim, isn't it? How about this one? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus, using God's own name, I am, Yahweh, Jehovah, in relation to himself. He's declaring himself to be God. How about this? He says, the Son of Man, that's in reference to himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and killed, and after 3 days rise again. Well, we realize that these are amazing claims, stunning claims. And we might ask ourselves, who says these things? That they're God? That they are the answer to the core problem of humanity? That after they're dead, they'll be physically resurrected? We have a place for people like that. In a padded cell with a very tight-fitting uniform. Why would reasonable people believe that Jesus is this type of person? And that really, in an important way, also challenges us to rethink the Jesus we thought maybe that we knew. It's very common in our culture to think of Jesus as, you know, a great moral teacher, you know, teaching the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the golden rule. Yeah, that's Jesus. Many people think of Jesus as a prophet. Many Jews have thought of Jesus that way. Muslims view Jesus as a prophet. But these are not things that a prophet would say. He's not saying, I know a way, I'm really wise. I've been sent by God to show you the way. He's saying, I am the way. And I think it's very important for us to reflect on this through the lens of C.S. Lewis in his book, Mere Christianity. Lewis says, I'm trying to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that is often said about Jesus. Namely, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Lewis says, that's one thing that we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. Great moral teachers don't say, here I am, I'm God, I'm the answer to the world's problems. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who thinks himself to be a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. And I think that that's really an honest assessment of it. You may conclude that Jesus is a liar. You may think that he is completely insane. Or you may consider, as so many of us here have in this room, that he is in fact the long-awaited Messiah, that he is the Lord himself. But don't walk away deluded with the thought that somehow Jesus is just all right. That Jesus is just a nice guy, a great role model, something like that. Great role models don't say the things that Jesus said. And Jesus did say these things, and that raises the question then, what evidence do we put forth in support of these claims? And Jesus says that you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. He says, these are the things that testify about me. He's pointing the gaze back into the Old Testament, into scriptures written hundreds of years before, and saying that they have all predicted who I am, what I'm about, what I'm doing. He says, after his resurrection from the dead in Luke 24, verse 44, he says, this is what I spoke to you while I was with you, that all things written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets and the Psalms, must be fulfilled. Jesus is looking back to the Old Testament, and he's saying, the whole narrative of the Old Testament includes a series of predictions that uniquely point to me, who I am, when I would come, what I would do, where I'm from, every important facet of who I am. These are things that were predicted long before I ever was. And so many of you are maybe sitting here this morning thinking, really? Prophecy. Seems like we've seen prophecy before. Like, for instance, a couple centuries after the beginning of the church, a group of people called them Montanists followed this guy named Montanus, who predicted Christ's immediate return And that Jerusalem would descend from heaven. And so Christians flocked to the wilderness of Turkey to wait. And wait. And wait. And he didn't come. And you're thinking to yourself, yeah, people have a lot of ideas about prophets. In 1806, a hen in Leeds, England, was alleged to lay eggs inscribed with the declaration, "Christ is coming," causing much panic for the people and great discomfort to the hen. Fairly recently, there's been attention focused on other kinds of predictions, like the prediction in the Mayan calendar that describes the end of the cycle of humanity at 2012, and that the end of the world was imminent. This was a big hubbub for quite a long time, actually, and 2012 came, and it went, and hey, we're still here. Or there is, of course, the old Nostradamus, famous Nostradamus, who is alleged to have predicted the end of the world very soon, namely July 2, 2019. So beware. Here's the prediction. An eclipse of the sun will happen in summer that ever existed, in such a way that they will judge the earth out of the orbit and send it to eternal darkness. The monster will be seen in broad daylight. Astronomers will interpret the effects of this body in another way, so no one will have provisions to face the aching poverty. That, as it turns out, is a prediction of the end of the world this summer. The interpretation holds that in 2002, NASA scientists detected a large asteroid heading in the direction of the Earth, and they gave it the name 2002 NT7 to the object that's 2 kilometers wide. It's a big thing. It may seem small compared to the size of the planet, but it would be enough to extinguish all living things with its impact. NASA keeps saying that the asteroid's chance of hitting the Earth is too small. However, Nostradamus warned that astronomers would be ignored and no one would be prepared for it. So there you go. Are you prepared for it? You know, so there's this sense like, what does that even say? And how do we get this date out of those lines? It just doesn't seem like there's anything in there that enables us to draw that kind of conclusion. We see similar things in recent Christian literature. A few years ago, there was a book written called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture is in 1988. Okay. And then, of course, Judgment Day, May 21st, 2011. And you're saying to yourself, really? Is that what we mean when we talk about prophecy? These absurd predictions that seem to really are almost like an astrology chart that you can interpret in any way you want. Predictions made about specific things that they come and they go and they're not fulfilled. And many of us here this morning, I'm sure, are just like, you know, so why would I even think about this issue of prophecy? Every time it's brought up, it's just the most foolish thing. And so I want to just make a couple of comments before we dive into some of the really important issues in biblical prophecy here this morning. Namely, that biblical prophecy is unique in the world's religions along two lines. First, that we have complete copies of the Old Testament that are datable to as far back as 200 BC in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And also Greek translations of the Hebrew Bible that were written at about 200 BC, so that we have multiple ways to confirm that the Bible that we possess today was the Bible that was known hundreds of years before the time of Christ, who claims that they speak of him. There is no later insertions, no scribe getting in there changing the narrative so that it fits Christ. Not at all. There's nothing like that. And secondly, and very importantly, there's no decoder ring necessary. But the Bible in its prophecies are very specific, that they are accessible to public scrutiny and access and analysis, and that just the normal tools of grammatical study enable us to get at an accurate meaning of what these texts are really all about. There's very little controversy. There's virtually no controversy on any end of the spectrum about the basic meaning of any of the passages that we want to examine this morning. And so I want to put forward to you here today a bit of a survey that covers very specific prediction with respect to the promised Messiah of the Old Testament about who, where, what and how, and when this Messiah would come. And I want to suggest to you that in relation to these very, very specific questions and the very specific answers that we find in the Old Testament, that there is within that a framework and a foundation for us to believe with our intellect intact, to have a level of knowledge that what the Bible declares in the New Testament about Jesus uniquely is the fulfillment of these predictions made hundreds of years before his birth. And that in relation to these things, we can be confident in a significant way, confident in a way that enables us to trust the proclamations, the things, the claims that Jesus says about himself, and entrust our lives to his word. Let's take a look. We want to begin first with the claim of who the Messiah is to be. Who qualifies to be the Messiah according to the Old Testament? Well, there are a number of passages that we could look at, but the central one comes in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, where he says, "A child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders. His name will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." That's a pretty unusual child. He goes on, "There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom." And so from this very, very brief description of the coming Messiah, a passage that is understood as messianic by all interpreters, Jewish and Christian alike, we can glean two important things. One is that here is a Messiah that comes from the family, the royal family of David, in fulfillment of God's promise to David that he would establish an eternal throne and that one of his sons would reign forever on it. And second, that this is no normal child. Here's a child that can be given words and descriptors like Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. And so who could this possibly be? You know, the New Testament opens in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 with this saying, "The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Now, does this prove that Jesus is the Messiah? No, it does not. What it does prove, though, is that Jesus qualifies to be Messiah because he is in the royal family line of David. The narrative goes on. It says that in Matthew 16, verse 16, the declaration of his disciples, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." You're not just a great moral teacher or a guy who came through this family, but just like Isaiah described it, you're the Son of God. Your origins are divine, not human. We move on. Where does the Messiah come from? Okay, so he has to come from the royal line of David. Where's that? Where's his birth? Well, Micah chapter 5, verse 2 says, "As for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be a ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." And so like the Isaiah 9 passage, Micah is here saying that a child will be born, but not a normal child, one who is from the days of eternity, an eternal being. And where? Namely, in Bethlehem. Why Bethlehem? Because that is David's family home. So to be Messiah, You must be from David's royal line and be born in David's hometown. And so the Bible tells us, in those days there was a decree that went out from Caesar Augustus that a census must be taken of all the inhabited earth. This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Joseph went up from Galilee into Judah to the city of David called Bethlehem because he was of the house of the family of David, and Mary gave birth to her firstborn son. Who? The unique son of David. Where? In the city of David, namely in Bethlehem. Let's get more specific. What will the Messiah do? And why? What's his job description? Let's turn to an important passage in Isaiah chapter 52 and into chapter 53. He says, "Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted, and he will sprinkle many nations." This is an introduction to a prophecy from Isaiah written at about 700 BC. We have a copy of this in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We know it to have been written hundreds of years before the time of Christ. Three things I want you to observe about this. First, he says, "My servant." This is the final of five what are sometimes called servant songs in the book of Isaiah. And they are messianic in the sense that the prophet is anticipating what God's Messiah will do when he comes to the earth. And so certain were the Jewish translators of the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic, the language of the Jews of the first century BC and the first century AD, that as they translated from the Hebrew into Aramaic this passage, they simply included, "My servant the Messiah." Here's a passage that was recognized pretty much universally in the first century to be about the coming Messiah. Second, it says what the Messiah will do. It says that he will sprinkle many nations. The verb here in the Hebrew is yasa, and it is used consistently, which is to say 100% of the time in the Old Testament, to refer to what a priest does at the altar. When a priest brings a sacrificial animal and takes its blood, he smears it on the altar. And this symbolizes a biblical principle of atonement. It says, every human being is guilty before God, and the wages of sin is death. We are all standing, we live in a state of death, and we are under a sentence of death, separation from God. But because God is merciful, because God loves, God has chosen to involve himself in the human drama and the human tragedy personally, and the way that he is involving himself is by a picture of sacrifice. And so the high priest, in splattering the blood of an animal on the altar, is symbolizing this idea of substitution, the death of an innocent on behalf of the guilty. And so Isaiah is declaring that the Messiah, when he comes, will have a priestly function, that he will offer up sacrifice. And offer up sacrifice for who? And this is our third point. Namely, for many nations. In other words, for all of humanity. Not just for Israel, but for all peoples. The universal scope of the servant's priestly work. We read on in chapter 53, the same prophetic oracle. He says, "All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the sin of us all to fall on him. He was cut off from the land of the living for the sin of the transgression of my people, who deserved it. The Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief if he would render himself a guilt offering. My servant will justify the many, as he will bear their sins." Okay, now we have a different profile of that same servant that was described just a paragraph earlier. The priest offers himself as the sacrifice. That is the job description of God's Messiah, to come and to offer himself as the sacrifice for the sins of humanity. That is why John the Baptist, in recognizing Jesus, before Jesus' ministry gets started, he says in John 1, "Behold, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world." John, the last prophet of the Old Testament era, recognizes in Jesus the fulfillment of this very passage. This is so very important for us to understand. What happened at the cross was no accident. It was a part of the plan of God from the very beginning that he would raise up his Messiah, born in the royal line of David, in the city of Bethlehem, to become both a priest offering sacrifice and the very sacrifice itself, because the blood of animals is merely a symbol. But Jesus took upon himself, an innocent man, the guilt of all humanity, so that he could experience the judgment of God, and because he is God, be raised from the dead and grant forgiveness to anyone who would simply humble their hearts and say, "That's what I want. My way to get before God is not to show him my credentials, how good and how religious I've been, certainly better than the next guy." God's unimpressed. God is offering forgiveness, not on the basis of our merits, but on the basis of his mercy. And he has accomplished this through his servant. That was his plan from the very beginning. And the pages of Isaiah make this very evident, that this was God's plan. And so we read that the Messiah is both priest and sacrifice. And the author of Hebrews puts it this way. He says, "When Christ appeared as high priest, he entered through a greater tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this world. And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption." This is God's answer to the human dilemma. We're in way over our heads. God knew that. And because he loves us, he's been pursuing us. And he was pursuing us through his long-awaited Messiah, who would take upon himself the burden of our guilt. That was God's game plan all along. Not just for the Jewish people, but as Isaiah says, for all the nations. And so we read at the end of history in Revelation chapter 5, the saying that you were slain, that you purchased for God with your blood people from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Worthy is the Lamb that was slain. I'm a big part of the reason why I'm up here this morning, and why I have been following Christ for 40 years, my entire adult life, is because of passages like this. The reality that this is not just some clever story that someone devised, some fairy tale, but it is something that is embedded in the very pages of history, that God intended all along for his plan for humanity to focus on this incredible moment where the justice of a holy God and the mercy of a gracious God come together in the person of Christ and the cross. And it was not an accident. It was planned from the very beginning. And why do we know this? Because the prophetic record makes it specific that that was God's intent. And now we want to move to a final area, this question. If we know what the Messiah came to do, we know who he had to be and where he's from, how about when will the Messiah come? That would be a very valuable piece of information, don't you think? If we could know when, according to the prophets, God's Messiah would be sent into the world. Well, we have that information as well. Let's walk this through. This comes from the book of Daniel, chapter 9, beginning in verse 24. It says, 70 Sabbaths. Sabbath is the Hebrew word Shabbat, which means seven. 70 Sabbaths have been decreed for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring everlasting righteousness, to complete prophetic vision and predictions. So this is Daniel. He's writing from Babylon. He's been taken captive. The Jerusalem was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, in 586 BC. Daniel and many of the royal family and some of the promising young people in Jerusalem were taken by Nebuchadnezzar into captivity into Babylon. And in that context, God raises Daniel up to be both a living ambassador of the God of Israel to the Babylonians, but also as a prophet declaring what God intends to do, that this is not the end of the story. That God has a plan for Israel beyond captivity, and it focuses on the Messiah. And so the prophecy begins with this prediction that 70 Sabbaths have been decreed for you and your people and your holy city, Jerusalem, which has been destroyed. To do what? To finish transgression. In other words, to bring the rebellion of humanity to an end. To atone for iniquity. We talked about atonement just a minute ago. That's what the Messiah would come to do. Deal with the problem of sin before a holy God. To bring in everlasting righteousness and to complete the prophetic record. He goes on, so you are to know that from the issuing of a decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be seven Sabbaths and 62 Sabbaths, and it will be rebuilt with plaza and moat, even under duress. And after the 62 Sabbaths, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the Prince who is to come will destroy the city and its sanctuary, and the end will come with flood of violence and destruction. Okay, let's break this down. Let's make sense out of what is being described here. Because I said it earlier on this morning that when we look at the prophecies of the Old Testament, we're not looking at a Rorschach test that just we read into it whatever we think is there. Whatever we want to see, we see. No, there is a context historically, and the grammar of the passage needs to be taken into consideration. And when we do these things, I think you will see clearly what interpreters of this incredible passage have noticed for literally millennia, that they point to the very time of the Messiah's coming. Let's break it down. He says, 70 Sabbaths have been decreed for your people and your holy city. What is he referring to here? The context is an explanation of why Israel was sent to Babylon for 70 years. And it has to do with the Sabbath. He says it says in Leviticus, this is from Moses, 1,000 years before in the law, in Leviticus chapter 25, it says, when you come into the land that I will give you, then the land must have a Sabbath to the Lord. Sabbath is the seventh day. It's a day of rest. The land also deserves a Sabbath. For 6 years you shall sow your field and gather its crop. But during the seventh year, the land must have a Sabbath rest. And you shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard on the Sabbath year. And so here we're introduced to the idea that there's not only a Sabbath day, a seventh day, but also, and very importantly, a Sabbath year, a seventh year. And God says that on that seventh year, there's to be no agricultural activity, that God will provide plenty in the previous 6 years to carry you over in that seventh year, and that the land requires its rest. So trust me, God says. We read on. It says again in Leviticus, this time in chapter 26, but if you don't obey me, the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you're in your enemy's land. So God is going to enforce that Sabbath year, whether Israel observes it or not. It will observe the rest, which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were still living in it. And so the prophet tells us, those who escaped Jerusalem from the sword were carried away to Babylon and lived as servants until the rule of Persia. This fulfilled the word of the Lord through Jeremiah that the land will have its Sabbaths for 70 years. Do you understand the context? This is very important. Daniel is saying that 70 Sabbaths have been given. What kind of Sabbath do we have in mind here? Well, in context, here's Daniel in Babylon. We know why they're in Babylon for these 70 years. It's because they violated the Sabbath year legislation. It couldn't be clearer than what we have right here in 2 Chronicles 36, and the passage that it's quoting in the book of Jeremiah. That means that the duration of Israel's stay in Babylon is rooted in the amount of years that Israel did not obey this Sabbath year legislation, this seventh year cycle that had to be obeyed. So 70 years of Babylonian captivity represent every single Sabbath year that Israel did not observe, a length of time of 490 years. See that? If it only comes once every 7 years, and there are 70 Sabbaths that were not obeyed, that's 490 years of disobeying God. That is a long time. But it is also key to our understanding of the meaning of this passage. And I want to make it very clear to you as well that this is not merely a Christian spin or interpretation on the Sabbath years. The Jewish interpreters view it in exactly the same way. I cite here Dr. Samuel Sandmel, the editor of the New English Bible's Old Testament, who is a Jewish rabbi and who in exactly the same way understands the 70 sabbatical years interpretation of this passage. Virtually everyone who's looked at it understands by virtue of its context why we must see the 70 years as Sabbath years reflecting the 490 years of disobedience that Israel had of God's word. So if you're with me, let's take this a step forward. It says, from the issuing of a decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem until, and now we have very specifically, Messiah, the Prince, there will be 7 Sabbaths and 62 Sabbaths. And so now we have a timeline beginning to form in which we know what will happen. The Messiah will come. When will the Messiah come? Well, after the completion of 62 Sabbath cycles and 7 Sabbath cycles. So specifically, 62 Sabbath cycles and 7 Sabbath cycles are 69 Sabbath cycles, again, which come every 7 years. So the prophecy itself is 483 years until the Messiah comes. It's a very specific number in a context that is very secure in terms of its meaning. So, 62 times 7, 7 times 7, 69 Sabbath years, 483 years. Very uncontroversial at this point. Well, we read on. In Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 and 5, it says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, I asked the king to send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. And Nehemiah chapter 2 goes on to describe all of the things that Nehemiah has requested from King Artaxerxes, the timber and other things to rebuild the city and to rebuild its walls, exactly as the prophecy in Daniel requires, that the city will be rebuilt, and that there will be a decree issued to make that happen. And that will become the beginning point of this 483-year process. Do you see that? If we knew when the 20th year of King Artaxerxes was, we would be in a position to know the beginning point of this prophetic timeline that goes the 483 years. Well, as it turns out, if you have Encyclopedia Britannica, sorry, that's passé. If you have a Wikipedia and you toggle in Artaxerxes, Wikipedia, bam, what will you find out? This is a man well known to history, a man who began his reign in 464 BC. There's no date, no debating this date. And in the 20th year, therefore, it's 444 BC. And so we have, without any doubt, the beginning point of this prophetic timeline. You're to know from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, you'll have these 483 years. But we can get even more specific than this. Because the way that that years were calculated in the Old Testament world was based upon a lunar calendar of 360 days. The way that we mark history is by a solar calendar of 365 days. So if we want to translate the lunar years of this prophecy's 360 days into the years that we mark history by, we would have to multiply the number of days in a year, namely 360 lunar days in a lunar year, times those 69, the 483 years, we get the specific number of days that the prophecy represents. If we divide that then by 365, the number of days in the solar year, we'll have an exact number of years that the prophecy represents to us in modern history. So 483 lunar years, 360 days. Multiply that, you get 173,880 days. A lot of days. If we divide that then by the number of days in a solar year, 365, that gives us 476 years. From 444 BC, where the prophecy begins, we march forward 476 years to Messiah. That brings us to 32 AD. Interesting. But there's more. Because on a number line, when you go from minus, representing BC, to plus, which is AD, on a number line, there's always a zero, right? You go from minus one to plus one, two spaces, right? But there's no such thing as a zero year. The year before 1 AD was 1 BC. And so, instead of thinking of this in terms of a number line and thinking of it as a timeline, we actually add a day to compensate for the zero year, which brings us to 33 AD. A date that is very familiar to us who are students of the New Testament, because this, as it turns out, is really the very best date for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Not just that we read this, however, in the Bible, but also we recognize Jesus' crucifixion from Jewish sources and Roman sources. And so the Jewish historian Josephus, in his History of the Jewish People called Antiquities, Josephus lived from 37 AD to 100 AD. He had firsthand knowledge of people who knew Jesus, who were a part of the religious council that ultimately put Jesus to death. And here's what Josephus writes. Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, that's the Jewish religious establishment, condemned Jesus to the cross. That's not from the Gospels. That's from Josephus's history of the Jewish people, the Antiquities. And similarly, Tacitus, the Roman historian who lived from 56 AD until 120 AD, wrote in his history of the Roman emperors, in the book called The Annals, this little tidbit. He says, Christians got their name from Christ, or Christus, who was executed by sentence of procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Now, Tacitus is writing his history not on the basis of his belief in Jesus Christ. Neither was Josephus. He's writing his history based upon firsthand historical documents of the Roman Empire itself. That's why his book is called Annals, because he's able to read official court records of Pontius Pilate and other governors and other places in the empire so that he can write an authoritative history of Rome. And in it, he mentions Christ's crucifixion under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. We know when Pontius Pilate's reign was under the reign of Tiberius. And it puts Pontius Pilate securing the death of Christ right in the 30s AD. And all of these streams now then are beginning to come together, where you have Daniel predicting in the 500s BC that a document would be signed to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, and that would begin the unrolling of a prophecy that would extend 476 years into the future and that would terminate on the person of the Messiah himself. And now we have, outside the Bible, specific confirmation of Jesus' death in exactly that time frame. Let's go back to Daniel where it says, after 62 Sabbaths, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Here again is a specific prediction of the cross, a specific prediction that the Messiah would come and would die. So the biblical record corresponds to the secular record exactly on this point. And so what we have then, in a very kind of brief way here this morning, is what F.F. Bruce has recorded in his unbelievably helpful book, Jesus and Christian Origins Outside the New Testament, when he says that Josephus, in his Antiquities, points out that Daniel specifically was unique among the prophets of the Old Testament because he was able to point to the very time at which the predictions would be fulfilled. Josephus is the one who understood the fulfillment, the completion of Daniel's prophecy in the time of Christ. This is no Christian interpretation of this passage. And so in just kind of summarizing where we've been, the Old Testament does indeed, in specific and understandable detail, tell us who qualifies to be the Messiah. Someone from the royal family of David who's not just merely a man. Where does the Messiah come from? Micah chapter 5, verse 2, Bethlehem. What will the Messiah do and why? Isaiah chapters 52 and 53, the priest who offers himself at the sacrifice. When will he come? Daniel 9, verses 24 to 27. He'll offer himself as a sacrifice in 33 AD. Now, I just want to draw a couple of conclusions here briefly as we end our session here this morning. And the first is simply to say that God is not silent. The reality of God's existence, the fingerprints of God are all over creation. Just as we said a few weeks ago, the finiteness of the universe, the extraordinary complexity of biological life, the unexplainability of sexual reproduction based upon the assumptions of biological evolution. The uniqueness of humanity as a conscious, free-choosing, rational being that seems to run very much contrary to the rules of nature, driven as they are by the determined laws of nature in which there is no freedom. Similarly, we have seen the fingerprints of God in the face of the incredible evil that we face as a humanity. That denying God's existence does not remove evil, it just removes hope. If there is no God, then whatever goes on in this world is just complete absurdity, pointlessness. Your life is pointless. The Bible, in a very unique way, upholds the dignity of humanity on the one hand and the corruption of humanity on the other, and provides God's solution to it in Jesus Christ. Why would we believe such things as this? Well, because we have a prophetic record. Predictions that were very specific, made hundreds of years beforehand, that point to the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. God is not silent. God has been pursuing us. God has been pursuing you. If you're here this morning and Christianity is something that is new to you, something that you've kind of given up on, and now maybe you're at a time in your life where you're prepared to re-examine a little bit, let this be a starting point for you, that there is compelling evidence from history, from the Bible, from science, from the very friends who brought you here and who have met Jesus Christ in a personal way. Oh, he's very much alive, and you can know him even today. At the end of the day, all of us, no matter who we are, where we're from, or what we believe, are betting our lives that something is true. I ask you, what are you betting your life on? Here, we offer a secure foundation in a God who speaks, and a God who acts, and a God who loves you and is calling on you. Just admit what you know to be true, that you're so full of pride, that you've kept God at his distance, that you live life your own way, and you realize just how alienated you are from him, maybe from other people, how broken you are. Now's an opportunity just to reach out to the God who is pursuing you, to receive the forgiveness that he freely offers you by the purchase of forgiveness through the cross of Christ. Just open your heart and receive him.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.